This is Laura Lane. It's May 8th, 2013, and I'm talking with rural historian, environmental writer, and author Jerry Apps. Thank you. It's nice to have you.
I'm very pleased to do it.
I saw on a preview of your documentary that you did with Wisconsin Public Television that you said that you believed where you grow up and when you grow up really influences what happens to you during the course of your life.
I believe that very strongly. And in my teaching, I reminded my students always that they ought to spend some time looking at their own personal histories and spend some time trying to understand what those histories were all about. Because the extent to which they're able to do that is the extent to which they're able to understand where they are now and likely where they're headed.
When you look at your own personal history, you were born in the town of Rose in Washera County. And if I'm correct, that's in the middle of the state.
Yeah, it's sort of south central.
Okay.
People living in Madison think it's in the north, but it's it's not.
When I went on, I looked at their website today, and it said that it's a very rural place. The current website says that there's no more than 2,500 people living in any town or village.
That is correct. For the longest time, there were no stoplights in the entire county. And then there was one. And when people would ask me, where do I live, I would say, sort of facetiously, 7 miles north of the only township in Washera County, or the only stoplight in Washera County.
Tell me a little bit about what it was like growing up. You obviously grew up on a farm. Tell me a little bit about what it was like growing up there and how you think that influenced the course of your own life.
Well, that, in a way, that's a difficult question. But in another way, I've written, I suppose, 10 books about that. It was, on the one hand, the most wonderful time that I could ever think of. And on the other hand, it was the most miserable time that I could think of. Now, that sounds a little bit strange, doesn't it? The wonderfulness of it, we were a close family. Family farms in those days, everyone in the family of twin brothers. We were all responsible for making sure that the family farm succeeded. So starting from the very earliest, when we were 3-4 years old, we were introduced to what we on the farm called chores, which meant carrying in wood because we heated our house with wood stoves, and carrying feed to the chickens and gathering the eggs and doing those kinds of tasks. And then my father was a great psychologist. He had us believing that as we worked up to these higher level chores, that was a tremendous advancement, and we should feel so pleased that we now have the opportunity to get up at 5:30 in the morning and milk cows by hand, which we did. I did twice a day. So those were some of the, and I have many more of those very positive things. On the negative side, especially in winter, our house was so cold. Once the wood stoves would go out about midnight, and we slept, my brothers and I slept upstairs in a room that was supposed to be heated by the stovepipe that went through the floor to the chimney. But of course, when the stoves went out, the entire house was, to give you an idea of what it would be like, stick your head in a deep freezer and hold it there for a while. That's how the upstairs was. We were piled deep with quilts, of course. We wore long underwear and wore our socks, and still you could see your breath when you were sleeping. And we would get up in the morning on a cold, cold, and 35 below zero morning. And you couldn't see out the windows. There were no storm windows, of course, and the windows were all covered with frost. And you'd make a little hole and you'd try to look out to see what the weather was that day. The warmest place on the farm, and I've said this many times, was in the barn, because the cattle gave off enough heat to warm the place up. And I would hurry down the stairway to the wood stove where my dad had started it earlier before he left for the barn, and dress, and then grab up my barn lantern and run out to the barn and gather myself under one of the cows, and that's was when I first warmed up. So that's some of the parts that were not so wonderful. A counselor one time asked me when I was at the university, what as they do on occasion. I don't suspect they do that as much today as they did then. What the question is, what do you achieve? What would you like to achieve in life? That was the question. I looked this counselor right in the eye and I said, I would like to achieve in life a warm floor in the morning to put my feet when I wake up. And he looked at me like, there's the worst loser that ever came down the road.
Did you have, being on a farm, did you have enough food and things like that?
Food was never a problem. I grew up in the middle of the Depression, where a lot of people did not have food and they didn't have a place to live. I always had a roof over my head. We had an enormous garden. I don't remember my mother ever purchasing vegetables from a grocery store. She canned everything. We didn't have electricity, so we couldn't freeze anything. But she canned everything. She canned green beans and corn and raspberries, and she made jams and jellies and pickles. And of course, sauerkraut, we were German. We ate well. That was never a problem. And there was never a lack of work. People are looking for work. We never lacked work. My dad was always able to find work for us, so that was not a problem. So it was from a physical perspective, if you discount the fact that we're working all the time, it was not bad. There's some strengths, some positive features of having something to do as well. I talk about this in my books. I talk about this in the documentaries I've done. But there were values coming out of that experience that I find to be extremely valuable. And when people look at the Midwest these days, and they look at the people who have some connection to the land, especially those who grew up directly on farms, there's something about the values that they hold that they find very beneficial today, such as appreciating doing a job well, showing up on time, doing the job, always trying to do it better than you'd done it previously, respecting authority, but also questioning it if it was going in the wrong direction, having a mind of one's own, being able to think and think critically and think often, and because there were a lot of jobs that were mind-numbing. Hoeing for 8 hours, 10 hours, a patch of potatoes is a mind-numbing job. However, once you get onto it, you get into the rhythm of it, there's a way of doing it that creates a rhythm, then it allows one's imagination to run all over the place. And I was filled, still am, with imagination, thinking of things, what would this be like if this was this way? What would that be like if that were that way? And so I had this wonderful opportunity to think, to have time to think while I was doing this job that didn't require very much thinking.
You know, as you describe it, was it meditative?
I didn't know that word, of course, when I was 8, 9, 10 years old, but in a sense, that's correct. And if you wanted, this is important too, I think, as a value, and I prized it, and I probably don't practice it enough. But there are times when I believe strongly that one needs to allow one's mind to go blank and not think at all. And you can do that when you're milking cows by hand, pitching hay, shocking grain, hoeing potatoes, making wood, and all the other jobs that we did on the farm. That once you learn the skill, and there was a skill to every one of these jobs, once you learned it, and you could read every book in existence and you could not learn how to do it from a book. You had to learn from your dad, from your granddad, and then do it. And you learned by doing it. Once you had all those skills in mind and were able to perform them, and the old man was on your case if you didn't do it well.
This being your dad.
I'm talking about my dad. And I say that with respect. I really do, because this is another value which may not be, it's not seen as important today as much as it was, as much as we practiced it then. But I don't recall my dad ever saying such things as good job or something like that. He wouldn't say that. You could tell if you were doing it right by the smile on his face, by the look in his eye. And if you screwed up, he let you know it straight away. I grew up with that kind of a value structure, and I don't remember ever that he patted me in the back and said, "That is really a good job." It was far more subtle than that, far more subtle.
But do you think that benefited you?
Well, it didn't harm me too much. But I do think sometimes we may overpraise for a less than adequate a job done.
When you said you were doing the chores on the farm, what things, you said you had a very creative, imaginative life. What things did you dream of as you were growing up?
Oh, for example, and I don't know if I would call this a dream as much as just an imagination. Our barn, with there are two barn lanterns, one on each end, when we were milking cows. And so in the middle of the barn, there were these deep shadows. And I envisioned dragons and ghosts and weird animals emerging from the shadows and rising up on their feet and maybe attacking us. There's a sort of a dumb thing to imagine. But in the shadows, one often wonders what's going on in the shadows. That's why one of my new books is called Shadows and Whispers. Oft times, what's important in the world is happening in the shadows, not where the bright light shines. So it's more than just, there's a reality as well as an imaginative experience when one thinks about shadows. I'm intrigued by shadows.
Tell me more about what you mean when you say there's more happening in the shadows than in the bright light.
I shouldn't say that's more. It's sometimes what's most important is happening in the shadows, and it's in and sometimes it's the depth of the information that we need to know to make an appropriate decision that is in the shadow, meaning metaphorically that we that it's there and we haven't taken the time to look for it. And I use whispers that metaphor in the same way. Oftentimes the most important things that are uttered in this society come from those who say it quietly.
It reminds me, because you said your dad. You said your dad was very subtle.
My dad was that kind of... You listen. He was not... He had a fifth grade education, that's all. And I learned quickly. There's a tremendous difference between being smart and being educated. Tremendous difference. Some of the smartest people I knew were those with limited formal education. And the converse, which I won't get into, is also true.
Let's talk a little bit about your own education growing up on the farm, in addition to doing the chores and working with your dad and the things that you learned from him. You went to school in a one-room schoolhouse.
Yes.
Tell me a little bit about what that was like.
Well, a one-room school, for those who may not know about it, all 8 grades in one room with one teacher, with no electricity, and heated with no indoor plumbing, and heated with a wood stove. That was my experience. The school on a cold, cold winter day was so cold in the front of the room that we would sit around the stove until noon often, because the rest of the building was so bloody cold. But Teresa Piaski, I was my first teacher. I'm 5 years old in first grade, just turned five. My birthday's in July, I'm just five. And I'm a wee little guy, and I am learning how to read. And that, to me, was the most marvelous thing. All of a sudden, the whole world opened up. Because here's this little farm kid who knows for nothing, because the community was well, we just didn't go anywhere. We couldn't and didn't. I'd be home to milk cows all the time. But I'm learning how to read, and Teresa Piaski was teaching me how to do that. The other thing, a bunch of things, all of a sudden I was learning. You learn from all the other kids, too, of course, because you can listen in on all the classes that are going on. But in those days, every country school, all the schools, had Christmas programs. And the country school, the Christmas program, was the social event of the year for the community. It attracted everybody. It attracted the parents, of course, and all the relatives and the bachelors and anybody who happened to be living within several miles would all come to the school for the Christmas program. And I already in first grade was a fairly independent little guy. And I said to Miss Piaski, when she pointed out that each of us was going to have to stand up on the stage and say our piece in front of all these people, our friends and relatives and brothers and all the rest of it. And I said, Miss Piaski, I don't think I want to do that. That does not, that's just going to scare me to death. As I was, and I still am pretty shy. You may not think so now. And she said, well, I have, and I've told other people this story, I have a secret that I'm going to share with you that's going to help you when you stand up on that stage wearing your new bib overalls and having all those people look out there. And so she whispered this little secret in my ear. I think she told every other kid the same thing, but she let me believe that I was the only one that knew this. And on the night of the Christmas program, everybody had to stand up, say your piece, would come that language today. Each one had to stand up and say something. Now, as a first grader, I think my little piece was, I would very much like to welcome all of you to our annual Christmas program, something like that. Just one little short line. And I practiced that with my mother, and I had it down cold, but I was shaking in my shoes because I knew when I looked out there, I'd see my brothers, and they'd be crossing their eyes and making faces. And, of course, that was the fun of all of this. And I stood up there, and I said my piece because I remembered this little secret that she told me. And the secret was this. When you see all that crowd out there, don't look at them, but look at the damper on the stovepipe way in the back. And everybody will think you're looking them right in the eye and you're not seeing any of them. And that's what I did. And I've been looking at the stovepipe the rest of my life.
Tell me a little bit. I want to talk a little bit about your mom, too.
Sure.
Because you just mentioned that you practice with your mom. What kind of role did your mom play?
Farm wives in the days when I was growing up had three or four very major roles on the farm. One was the health and welfare of the family. Second one, she was in charge of the garden and the vegetable growing. And third, she was in charge of the chicken flock. And we had 100, 125 Leghorn chickens. And those eggs she traded for groceries. Mm. Bartering was very much in order in those days. So whatever groceries you needed, she traded for them. My mother also was very much, she had a seventh grade education. Both my parents were pulled out of school when they were old enough to work. My mother worked as a maid for the lumberyard. My mother and father both, but mother especially, she saw education as something extremely important. And we did our homework under her guidance every night without fail, along with her keeping a watch over our various illnesses. And in those days, everything imaginable came down the road. I had scarlet fever. And we were quarantined with a big sign on the house for a couple of weeks. Whooping cough, diphtheria and smallpox we were vaccinated for, but everything else, there weren't any vaccinations yet, including polio, which I had along the way. But my mother was very, very much, and she did all the bookkeeping for the farm, too, because she had a little more education than my dad, and she kept all the books. And in fact, she was such a historian, and she didn't know it. She never threw away anything. And when she died, I found all of these account books, and I wrote a book based on her account books, because her account books were they showed the history of our farm. 5 cents for this, 10 cents for that, 50 cents expended this way. Everything written down very carefully, year by year by year. So she had an extremely important role in my life and for our family.
you said that she was the watchful eye on your health and on your brother's health. You just came out with a new book, and I heard what somebody called, I read an online review, and somebody called it your most personal work to date. And this is, I'm referring to the book about...
it's called Limping Through Life.
Right, your book about your experience with polio. Yeah. I read that you woke up, I believe I read that you woke up with a sore throat one day.
That is correct, and a terrific headache. When I came home from school, I'm 12 years old, 8th grade, at country school. I came home from school at night and told my mother this, and I was very, very tired, exhausted. But it was a nice January day, and we'd been sliding out here with our sleds, and it was a wonderful day. We had a great time. And she thought I was just tired from having done all of that. By the next, the next morning, it was just, my throat was about closed and my head was just bursting. And within a day or two, my right leg was paralyzed. Those were the days when polio was rampant all over the country. And Wisconsin was not excused. Wisconsin had the Fox River Valley, especially Nina, Menasha, Oshkosh, Green Bay, you know, south of Fond du Lac. They had more incidence of polio than any other little area like that in the country. Just thousands of cases. And the Wild Rose Hospital, and we had a hospital in Wild Rose, started in 1941, was filled with polio victims. The halls were lined with iron lungs. I took kinds of polio, paralytic and bulbar. Bulbar is the respiratory polio. Most of the polio victims in the iron lungs died. Our neighbor boy died. The doctor said to me, Jerry, you are really lucky. I said, how can I be lucky? Can't even stand up. And he said, you're lucky because you're not dead. Can you imagine being a doctor in those days with seeing death among these young people just rampant? And it was so frightening because nobody knew what caused it. They could not figure out how it was transmitted. And many remembered the 1918 flu epidemic that was across the world and was true, and it was here in Wisconsin. So they thought it was transmitted through the air, and it wasn't. It's a virus that's in the digestive system, not in the respiratory system. That changed my life entirely. There's no question about it. And one of the reasons it's a personal story is that I wouldn't talk about it. I didn't talk about it for 60 years. I didn't want anybody to know. This sounds so strange when I think about it now. I didn't want anybody to know that I had this disease that caused me to do things differently. I'm finding, since I've written this book, I'm hearing from polio survivors all over the country who are sharing their story, and they're saying the same thing. We were ashamed, I don't know why, but we were ashamed, they said, I said, ashamed to share the misery of what that disease was all about. And its psychological effects were so, so much greater than the physical, and we can get into that a little bit later. Just last week I heard from a woman who had, who was a polio survivor, and she had four, there were four kids in the family, all four had polio, two died, and the other two were severely impaired. And she said, I was so ashamed, I've told nobody about this. And now it seems to be, if you can write a book about it, it must be okay. Mm. And so I'm hearing that from all over the place.
When you were 12, how long did it take for you to know what you had?
This sounds strange as well, but it was very much the way it was in those days. Foreign people did not go to doctors unless you were near death. So it must have been almost a week before I really knew that that's what it was. We didn't get to the doctor. There was always this, wait a day or so and you'll feel better. And that didn't happen. And we finally, they took me to the doctor, and by that time I couldn't stand up. They had to carry me into the car. And that's when I found out. And one of the most poignant moments, as I remember it, and I write this in the book, was when my folks heard that that's what it was. And farm kids had to be active. I mean, you didn't have anybody in a wheelchair on a farm. Well, you could, but it didn't work very well. And the look on my dad's face when the doctor said, your son has polio and will probably never walk again. He said, my dad had this look on his face. He stood there with his cap in his hand. And the look on his face was the same look he got when one of his best cows died, if you can imagine what that would be like. I've never forgotten that.
Tell me about a little bit about the physical effects that you experienced.
Well, the headache went away, the sore throat went away, the paralysis did not go away. And now we bring in another country school teacher into the story. Faith Jenks was her name, my eighth grade teacher. In those days, everybody in the country school had to pass a county-wide eighth grade examination in order to be eligible to go to high school. And that meant a day of writing tests of everything from math to social studies to science to whatever it was, at the county seat, with all of the kids in the county all coming together from all the country schools. And there were 40, 50 country schools in a county like Washera. And Faith Jenks knew that if I was going to get into high school, I was going to have to pass this exam. And I was out of school, of course. I was at home. Every day at the end of school, she would come out to the farm and bring me the lessons that I needed for the following day, and then she would pick up what I had done. And my dad made a little desk for me out of orange crates, wooden orange crates, and put a board across it, and I could sit in this chair and look out the window, Winterstein, and work on my lessons. And Faith Jenks succeeded in getting me through my eighth grade examinations and allowing me to go to high school.
I read that you said that when you get something like polio or anyone contracts such a debilitating disease, that you need help. And I read about how you were talking about having to ride on the tractor and how your father had this kind of approach to physical therapy, although he didn't obviously know that was, but that he made you get on the tractor.
He did. And I was so angry with him for doing that. And I was just an ornery, despondent, depressed, whatever adjective you want to use, little kid. I mean, nobody wanted to be around me. My brothers avoided me. Of course, they probably a good thing, so they didn't catch polio. But by April, this had happened in January, by mid-April, I lost a lot of weight. I couldn't stand up. I don't know why we didn't have any crutches. I got around with a chair. That's how I moved around. I don't know if they weren't available. I don't know that story. So it was a time where I was just ornery as could be. And my dad said, we've got spring work to do. I don't know if he knew what was going to happen or not, but he said, your arms work, don't they? And I said, well, that's right. Your head seems to work, yes. We just had a tractor for a year or so. We farmed with horses all through the war. Got a tractor, I think, in 45, so this has been only a couple of years. I had a Farmall H, and a Farmall H tractor, the front wheels are close together, back wheels are apart, and to turn it, when you get to the end of a field, you have to use one or the other of the brakes on the right side. If you're turning to the left, use the left brake, turning to the right, use the right brake. And this right leg, which is the one that was paralyzed, it simply didn't work. It was bent at a 45-degree angle. And the story that I tell in the book, and I've told other people, going across the field, pulling the disc as we were preparing corn ground, come to the end of the field, and I'm trying to turn, and of course the tractor won't turn just with the steering wheel, you got to use the brakes. And I tore out some fence and all of that. And I thought, that's it. My dad's going to come chew me out and send me back home. But he didn't. In fact, he didn't say anything. The only thing he said is, are you okay? I said, well, I'm okay. I smashed all the fence. He said, well, climb off. And I said, well, that's probably it. I said, he's going to take me home now. He turned the tractor around. He said, now get back on. You're not through yet. And I, by 2 weeks, I had, I was able to use my leg enough to work the brakes. He also, every night, this sounds a little quaint, but it's true. We had a great big bottle of Watkins horse liniment, and he would take this horse liniment and rub on my knee every night. It hurt like the bugger from trying to bend it, and he would just massage it like everything. And in 2 weeks, by golly, I could stand up and I could I learned how to walk again.
He sounds loving. You said he was subtle, but as I hear you, as I hear you talk about the story, and you talked about, you know, the look on his face when he finds out that his son has this.
Oh yeah.
This,
oh sure.
As you talk, I mean, he sounds loving. Do you?
Yeah, I suppose today we would call that tough love. I suppose. I didn't understand it. I didn't understand what he was doing. I was just, I was so out of it, emotionally. I was just a wreck. But he knew. Oh, he knew.
So you think that he did? That he did?
Oh yeah. Yeah. He had it figured out.
Yeah.
And there wasn't such a thing. At least I wasn't. I'm sure there was. There was no physical therapy available. There just wasn't such a thing.
So I want to talk about the psychological effects, but let's talk about the physical a little bit more.
Sure.
So, you know, within 2 weeks you're driving the tractor again. You were in the Army later on, so how did you...
Oh, see, now this is the part, this comes to the part of not letting anybody know you had it. I could never run. I could sort of wander along. I could not move very quickly, but I could walk with a slight limp. And as far as the Army is concerned, somehow or another, if I'd said I had polio, that'd been it. Didn't have to go to the Army or do anything. But in those days, you did not want to be different. If you were 4F, and that's what the category was called, then you were an outcast. You were not patriotic. You somehow were a malingerer. You got out of something, and that's the last thing I wanted to happen. So this doctor, the Army doctor that examined me, he never asked me. I had polio. He looked me over and he said, you look fit, and stamped me on the back, and that's it. I was off to ROTC in good shape. And that was true of a lot of other things. I simply did not tell anybody.
Why do you, you know, it sounds like you talked about the sense of being ashamed of
it. Exactly.
Did you know how you got it? I read that you did not know how you got it.
I have no idea.
So do you think you and other survivors felt guilty, like somehow you had brought this upon yourself?
No, I don't. That's not it. As much as if you're incapacitated, you are in the country, in that my generation, you were inadequate. There's something else too that went on, that's awful. There was also this notion that if you were physically incapacitated, that also meant that you were mentally deficient. And oftentimes it's just the opposite. The persons who have some kind of physical disability, their mental capacity is enhanced. But there was a lot of that going on in those days. If you have any kind of deformity, a limp or anything like that, they quickly equated that with a mental deficiency. I didn't want to be thought stupid.
With your polio, you know, it sounds like you could walk. So what happened? Like, did you go back to school? When did you go back to school? When did you, like, sort of...
Yeah, I went back to school by, April, once I could walk again. And this is interesting, too, because the big deal in the country school in those days was softball. And the various schools in the area played each other in softball. And the teachers were very, they all knew each other, of course, and they were very competitive with each other. And so they wanted their team to win. And so we had practice always, should have anyway, prior to these games. And the first thing in the spring, they would line up practice teams. And if I remember correctly, the two seventh graders, Jim Kolka and Mildred Swindrzynski, that's Swindrzynski, in case you want to spell it, were the team leaders, and neither would select me.
Is it because they knew you had, did you, I mean,
well, sure, they knew, well, everybody knew, of course.
Okay.
And they, why would you want to have a player who can't run, for heaven's sakes? He's worthless. Again, my teacher, Faith Jinks, said, I think we'll make Jerry the pitcher for both teams because you don't have to run a lot when you're the pitcher. So I was the pitcher. And I either, when I batted, when we, it was a little strange, and I tell this story in this book too, we'd play a school. I either fell down on my way to first base and was out, or hit a home run. I had very, very strong arms because once one part of you is incapacitated, you develop the other part. I think, you know, my arms are really strong. So I could hit a home run, and did ever so often. So that was a really kind of a strange, interesting time.
I also read that you said when you get a debilitating illness, like polio, that there are two paths you can take. And one path you said is, you know, can eventually become an alcoholic. And
have a life of depression.
Right, life of despair.
Yeah.
The second route would be to become an overachiever.
That's right.
And you said you took the second path.
That's right. And that's still in my head. I can't get over it. Earlier you'd mentioned that you have three books out this year. Doesn't that sound like overachievement to you?
Yes. Well, you know, you said, I read that you said you had a sense of, you know, after you had the sense of worthlessness inside you. You know, and you've described the stigma that was attached, this terrible, not only experiencing this horrible physical condition, but the stigma that was attached. And you talked about, you know, overachieving. Why do you think you chose the second path?
I don't know. I really don't. Other than, I don't think my folks would allow it to happen.
They wouldn't allow you to go the despair.
That's right. And the story that I told a little while ago about when I was this depressed, paralyzed kid, feeling totally worthless, my dad could have, I could have spent my life in a wheelchair, but he wasn't going to let that happen, if at all possible. And it didn't.
When you went into high school, I read a little bit about that you became an announcer.
Oh, the high school experience. I have an interesting record in the books, which I wasn't even aware of. My editor spotted it. On the first day of school, every boy was expected to go out for baseball. And I'm standing at the plate, and the pitcher, I happen to know all the names, I remember all the names. Cliff Simonson was the pitcher. Marty Inda, they were juniors. Marty Inda was the catcher. And they wanted to test these freshman boys to see if they're able to be eligible to be on the baseball team. And Cliff Simonson had polio too, by the way, later, had the reputation for breezing a fastball right by somebody's nose just to see what they would do. Well, that first pitch came across, and of course I can't move very fast, and it hits me right here. And I'm knocked cold. And I remember looking up, and there are all these people looking down at me, and I said, well, are you all right? I said, I don't think so. I have a lump on my head. And the record that I have is in the annual, senior annual book that lists all the graduates and all that stuff. And it says what you were involved in. It says baseball for me. Baseball one, meaning I was on the team during the freshman year. My record is I have the shortest period of time in a baseball team in the history of the game, one pitch. So Mr. Wright, the coach, Paul Wright, wonderful man. He's the person who said, Jerry, it doesn't look to me like you're going to be able to play baseball. But he said, there are two or three things I want to suggest. Would you mind announcing the basketball games? I said, I don't know, I've never done that before. Well, he said, all you do is you have to talk into a microphone. I've been talking into a microphone since I'm 14 years old. He also said, you might find it interesting. In fact, you might even find it useful, understatement of the year, to take a typewriting class. In those days, no boy would be seen taking a typewriting class. Typing was for girls, for heaven's sakes. And here I'm in this classroom, this laboratory, where all of these L.C. Smith upright manual typewriters, girls, all girls, me. I'm sitting there, I'm looking around, and why am I here? These girls got all these nice, long fingers, and I got these little stubby fingers that are milking cows by hand. What I didn't realize at the time, when we began taking the typewriting tests, 30 minutes or 40 minutes a minute, 50, that I'm smoking the girls. And why is that? My little finger, I can handle the A, and their little pinkies didn't have enough strength. I'm milking cows by hand. These little pinkies, the semicolon they don't use so much, but the A use a lot. So of course, that led me to becoming assistant editor of the newspaper, and then editor of the newspaper, and I was writing all the editorials and writing most of the articles, and I was just having a grand time. I didn't know what plagiarism meant in those days, so I was taking stuff out of Reader's Digest and putting them in my editorials, and it was just a fun time because I could type. Anybody could type had a leg up when it came to doing something on the newspaper, because whatever you typed, that's what got printed, because you typed it directly on hectograph paper. That's what we used as a reproduction method. So I had a staff of 12 when I was a senior in high school, of reporters doing all kinds of things. It was a marvelous time.
Did you think about it being your life's work at that time?
Heavens no.
Why?
I don't know. It was just so interesting. Also, Paul Wright got me into public speaking, forensics, and I was doing competitive public speaking all over the place and writing my own speeches. He said, you ought to... You shouldn't be memorizing this other stuff. He says, I want you to write your own speeches. So I did. I've been doing it ever since.
When you graduated from high school, you went on to college at UW-Madison.
That was an accident, by the way.
I was going to ask you, tell me, were you expected to go to college, or were you expected to farm? Was it unusual that you headed to college?
In my high school graduating class, nobody went to college. Not no one. A couple maybe did later after the war. This is Korea War. But I got a scholarship. Here, this bunged up kid who can't run and play baseball and all the rest of it, I discovered one day when the principal called me into his office. And you don't want to be called in the principal's office. Even today, I guess you won't like that. But I thought, oh my gosh. My immediate thought was, I have written something in one of these editorials that's too far over the top. I'm in trouble. And that's what I thought I'd done. Because they just let me do what the heck ever I wanted to do. I wrote about everything under the sun. So I'm sitting there opposite Mr. Rozica. I think he had a first name, but nobody ever knew it. Mr. Wazika looks me right in the eye and he says, I have some news for you. And I thought, oh my gosh, I know what's coming next, because I'd heard from others. He starts out easy, but boy, just wait. He gives you, he lets you think the things are going to be good, but look out. So I'm ready. And he looks me right in the eye and he says, I have good news for you. I said, what is that? He says, you are valedictorian of your high school class. I says, really? Nobody paid any attention to the grades. I mean, just you just didn't do that. This comes back to that old value I talked about before. Do the best you can with what you've got. That's what my dad always said. And so here I am. My gosh, I'm valedictorian. He says, there's something else that I need to tell you. I said, what's that? He says, as valedictorian, you will receive, you're eligible to receive one semester's free tuition to the University of Wisconsin in Madison. I said, really? And he told me what it was worth. And I went home that night, and my dad had real, I'm the oldest of the three kids. I know he expected me to come back on the farm. And I said, he's working out in the barn, I go out and help, as I did every night when I came home from school. And I said, I have some news to tell you. He didn't say anything. A little while, he said, what news do you have? I said, I'm a valedictorian of my high school class. He said, really? What does that mean? He didn't. Yeah, well, how should he know? He'd never been to high school. And I said, well, that means I'm first in my class. And he said, well, that's good. And I thought, well, gee whiz. I says, there's a little more to it. And he says, what is that? And I said, I'm eligible to receive a scholarship to go to the University of Wisconsin in Madison. For the longest time, he said nothing. That was not what he wanted to hear. And then he said to me, what is that scholarship worth? And this will knock you right off your chair. $63.50. And then he stopped, and for a while, he didn't say anything again. And then he said, and I don't want this to sound like it was different than he meant it. He said, that's a lot of money. You ought to go down to that Madison place. You just might learn something there. What he meant was that you might learn something that we can use back on the farm.
Because he knew
I'd always been interested in agriculture, and he knew that is what I would likely want to study. He also knew, I think, that once this kid went off to Madison, that he would likely not be back on the farm.
You think he knew that? He realized you would not be coming back?
Yeah, I think he knew that. He didn't say that. He could have said at that time, I think you should let somebody else have the scholarship, and you should come back on the farm. But he didn't.
Do you think he was proud of you?
Oh, I think so.
Yeah, I think so.
In his own way.
Yeah. And what, you said education was so important to your mom. What was your mom's reaction?
Her reaction was, how in the world are we going to get along? How can you ever live in Madison? We have no money. She's the bookkeeper now. She knows what we've got. It's nothing. The year previous, 1950, we'd lost all our cows to brucellosis disease. Mm-hmm. And so the income was nothing. We were just making it, just barely. And so her concern was, what are you gonna wear? And what are you gonna eat? And where are you gonna live? And even though the tuition is taken care of, you've gotta live there. And this is all in this book too, which I've not written about before. We came down here to Madison, my mother and I, and some friends from Chicago who knew how to drive in a city, because nobody knew how to drive in a city. I certainly didn't. I had a driver's license then. And we found a room for $5 a week that had...
Where was it?
On 112 North Orchard Street. Which is the street that runs by the new Discovery Center. And that's the street. And it was I spent 4 years in that room. It had a window and a storm window. And as soon as it got cool enough, I would have a quart of milk and some orange juice and some bologna and in the window. And I'd have the bread in the dresser drawer. I ate one meal a day away. The others I prepared in my own room. And I think my limit was 65 cents. I couldn't spend more than 65 cents a day for a meal.
So how did you get through the 4 years of college? Because the scholarship was for one semester.
Yeah, and then there was another scholarship, and then there was another. And I almost flunked out of the first 6 weeks, because I didn't do well the first 6 weeks because my high school chemistry course was so pathetic, and my physics in high school was not physics, because the instructor simply wasn't prepared to teach those topics, and so I spent the first semester essentially doing remedial work. But I'd like to read, and I knew how to study, and I was by myself. I was enjoyed being by myself, and so I really worked at it. I'm up at 5:30 in the morning and I'm studying.
Back to that the farm work ethic.
And I was bound determined I was not going to go back to Wild Rose, having received a scholarship and not able to make it. Because that's a big deal. I'm off to the great University of Wisconsin in Madison, for heaven's sakes. And I was bound determined I was going to make it. Well, I graduated with honors, so it worked.
Was it a culture shock in Madison?
Oh, my gosh. It still is. I never got over it. Yeah.
Describe.
It was just awful. I mean, I am used to a night of quiet, a night of stars everywhere. A night where I might hear in the distance an owl calling. And what do I hear in the city? Sirens and trucks and cars and exhaust fumes everywhere. And hated it. And nobody could understand. I'm up at 5:30 in the morning, and everybody, what's going on? There isn't a soul around. 5:30, let's get on with it here. This is the day is broken. It's time to get to work. Thankfully, there were a lot of farm kids in the ag school at that time. So.
Yeah, I wanted to ask you about that. Did you make close friendships with other kids that were coming from similar backgrounds?
Sure, yeah. This no money thing, I had to find jobs always. And some doctor living on Lake Mendota, I wish I had remembered his name. One of the first jobs I had was to go on Saturday morning to appear at his home, beautiful big home on Lake Mendota, and polish all his shoes and his wife's shoes. And it was so hilarious because he must have figured me out right away, because I polished shoes every Saturday. They didn't need polishing, for heaven's sakes. They just were shown. Then one day he says, one Saturday, I'm to help him take in his pier from Lake Mendota. As this must have been in early, late October. And I dropped his fancy wrench into the lake, and it sunk to the bottom. I thought, oh God, this is it. He didn't say anything. He said, we'll get another wrench. And so he just kept me going. A lot of people helped me out like that. Another kid living across the hall in this rooming house, he had these side jobs as well. He was a year or two ahead of me. And he said, I tell you what, he said, I've got a job painting fire escapes downtown. Would you like to help me? So I'm painting a fire escape on the gay building down on the square. And I don't know, however. And he said, you use a small brush, he says, because it takes longer, because we were paid by the hour. Can you imagine hanging this stupid fire escape, painting every little metal just all the way down? And then when we got through with that, he said, now we're going to I've got a job painting, putting up storm windows. And so we're putting up storm windows on a four-story. Geez, I'm not very keen on heights, and my bum leg wasn't helping me, so we did that. Then when it finally got too cold to do that sort of stuff, I got a job at the seed lab in the agronomy department, counting seeds for germination tests. That was just the worst job in the world.
But you were prepared. You did all these sort of
I knew how to do. I could do this.
Yeah.
But broom grass, I did not know about broom grass. That was a relatively new agricultural grass at the time. and they were just introducing, the agronomy department was developing some new varieties. And so they're doing the germination tests, and the broomgrass seed is so indistinguishable that you have to look at it over a light, because a lot of the chaff, it looks, everything looks like chaff. Some of the chaff is a seed and some of it's not. So you look over a light to pick out those that are, that have a seed, and you count them in 100, you put them in a petri dish, and I go, oh, damn, 50 cents an hour. Finally, I got this lead on a job in the music school. And this was the most wonderful thing. I spent then, I think, 3 years working in the music school. I was in charge of setting up the orchestra, where all of the... I didn't know a bassoon from a snare drum, but I learned. S.T. Burns was the head of the music school in those days. And he took a liking to me. I think they all felt sorry for me. I don't know. But 50 cents an hour. I worked 40 hours a week there. I worked every night, every weekend. I got 40 hours a weekend, and that really saved me. So I set up the orchestra, but the most fun thing I had was I was in charge of the practice room on Park Street. It's been torn down now. The amenities building is where it used to be. And this was an old apartment building. I think it was one, two, three, about three stories high with a basement. And all of those apartment rooms were practice rooms for music students. So they practiced piano in one, violin in another, and trumpet in another, and so on. And I was in charge of allotting the times to the music students. I had this little schedule, and I had a little room under the stairway. I learned how to study with all this noise going on. Oh my God, the thing when nothing was soundproof. There was just everything going on at the same time. And everybody had an hour. Of an hour time to practice. And then my job, besides signing them up, I was in charge of, as what I called it, smoking and smooching and the prevention thereof. And so every half hour, I would make the rounds. I'd go around all of the practice rooms. And I would stand in front of the door, and I would first smell. See if I could smell smoke. You're not supposed to be smoking in these practice rooms. And then if I heard no sound at all,
right.
I would politely knock on the door. And I would find out what kind of music was occurring in that room at the time. Sometimes it was more quite different from what was supposed to be happening there. I never once outed any student for doing something inappropriate. So I was a big hero in the music school. But I said, look, cut it out. You're in trouble. Go some other place. That happened a lot. So those were my big, I had more friends in the music school among music students than I had in the ag school, which sounds a little strange.
When you finished up your degree, you studied agriculture.
Yep.
And when you finished up your degree, did you know what you were going to do? Or what were your thoughts?
Oh, I was supposed to be a VOAG teacher.
Vocational education?
Yeah, vocational ag teacher in high school. That was my first degree was that sort of preparation.
Okay.
But then I was commissioned in the ROTC as a second lieutenant, and was to go on active duty, and so nobody would hire me. The very first job I had upon graduation was raking cranberries by hand in Wisconsin Rapids area. I have a book on that. One of my novels is called Cranberry Red. It's based on the history of the cranberry industry. So I knew it firsthand because I worked in it. So I did that. That was a terrible job. And I didn't want anybody, oh my gosh, to know there that I had a degree from the university, that I was a second lieutenant in the Army. For heaven's sakes, these are all paper mill workers. They have limited education. And could they ever work? Oh my gosh. So I'm just a hustling to keep up with them. But that was the first job I had before I went into the Army, and then in January.
And you were in we talked about you're in the Army for 6 months, and then you...
It was a new program, okay. Because I was supposed to be... The first orders I had were to go to Germany for 2 years. And I was really looking forward to that. And I sold my car and sold most of my clothes and all that stuff. I'm ready to go into the Army, because I would have liked to have gone to Germany for 2 years. But then, it was about shortly after the 1st of January, George Collum was the depot agent in Wild Rose. And I was at home,
What was the what agent?
Depot agent at the depot, train depot.
Oh, okay, train depot, okay.
Train depot agent.
Okay.
And he's a telegrapher too, of course. They were all telegraphers at the time. And George said, Jerry, I knew him because everybody knew everybody in these little small towns. He said, Jerry, I've got a telegraph for you from the Army, and I can't figure it out. He says, got a lot of letters, and of course, Army is full of jargon. He says, you come on down here, and you help me figure this out, and because it's for you. So I go down to the depot, and we sit there, and we figure this thing out. And it is a new program the Army is announcing where you spend 6 months on active duty and 6 years in the reserve. And so that's what that was about. And I thought that was kind of interesting. But now all of a sudden I've changed everything because I had planned to be away for 2 years and now I'm going to be back in 6 months. And that's when I decided to, well, those 6 months, I don't know that I want to teach high school. I'd done the practice teaching, and that was all kind of interesting. But I wanted more freedom, I guess, than to be confined. And nothing wrong with it. That's a wonderful occupation, and I've known a lot of ag teachers. But it just didn't seem to fit what I wanted to do. So when I came back, I stopped at in Ag Hall to see my old major professor, Walter Barocker was his name, just died. A couple of years ago, and Walt said, "Jerry, we've just hired a new professor from in the department who just finished his degree in Michigan State, and he has a research assistantship. Would you be interested in that?" And that's what I did.
When did you decide you got a master's degree too?
Uh-huh.
And that was in
1957. See, that's that first year I came back. I enrolled again in 56. I did it. This is unheard of, too. I'm bragging now, but I finished in two semesters, the master's program. Nobody did that.
And tell me, with the master's, what did you focus on? I know it was agriculture and education.
Yes, right.
And what does that mean?
That meant that I was transitioning into education, non-formal education, which would include extension, and which is what I went into, and all those sorts of programs. Because I really got interested. I had been in 4-H as a kid, and I knew the county agent. I never, ever thought that I could do that. That seemed so far remote, so above anything that I could ever do. My first aspiration was to be a country school teacher. I mean, that seemed to be appropriate for me. And then as I learned about new things, I thought, geez, that'd be kind of fun to do. I wonder if I could do that. And all of a sudden, I discovered, by golly, I could do that. And I did.
Talk a little bit about what a county extension agent does.
It's different now than it was then, but I'll tell you what it was then. This is in 1957 that I became a 4-H club agent in Green Lake County, which meant I was in charge of the recruitment of volunteers as leaders for 4-H clubs that ranged from 8, 10, 12, 15, 20 kids that met together. I was largely responsible for the county fair, for music festivals, drama festivals, speaking contests, camps. I was camp director for our county and Adams County together. It would be somewhat comparable to what a YMCA person would do with a very different focus. We were faculty members of the University of Wisconsin. I was an instructor then on the ranking system. A lot of people didn't realize that we were faculty members of the College of Agriculture at that time. I wrote a weekly column for a newspaper. I did a couple of radio programs a week. I loved radio. I still do a lot of radio. WCWC radio station just opened. Jim Densmore whom I'd known from Marquesan, was the farm director, and Jim said, "How would you like to do?" He knew I liked radio and he liked my voice, so I did a couple. I did a lot of radio with Jim.
Now that weekly newspaper. Now was that? I've read a lot about that Outdoor Notebook. But that
well, that's a different deal. That's my freelance deal.
Okay, that was later. That's
a different deal.
What? So let's hold that for a minute. What? When did you decide to get the PhD? At some point, you decided. Did you have?
Well, that's an interesting story, because I from Green Lake County, I moved to Green Bay. And Green Bay, Brown County, was a wonderful opportunity for anybody interested in communications, because there were three television stations operating there. I was doing at least one television program a week. There were, I don't know, three, four radio stations. I would tape a program that played on all these radio stations. I'd do that once a week.
And what were you?
I was livestock agent and 4-H. Livestock agent meant I was responsible for the informal education of the beef farmers, the hog farmers, and the sheep farmers. That's the livestock part of it. I judged county fairs. I was on the livestock judging team here at the university, so that sort of prepared me for doing this.
When you were on the TV, like, were you talking about livestock then, or like what kinds of stuff were you doing?
Oh, yeah. In fact, they didn't care. I talked about anything I wanted, really. I talked about bluebird. I was very active in the Audubon Society up there, and I would talk about bluebirds one day and sheep production the next day. Tell you a quick story. We very often they want me to bring live animals into the show. This predated any kind of taping. Everything was live, and we had some adventures like you can't imagine with live animals in the TV studios, because these were not digital cameras. They had tubes and they were hot, and the big lights come down and animals react very differently when the lights come on. I have all kinds of stories about that.
So you were up in near Green Bay, and then at some point you decided to return to Madison.
I didn't decide, but I did decide. Frank Campbell was the state 4-H leader at that time, and this would be so illegal today. Frank, I'd been in Green Bay for, and he knew I was doing all this stuff. I mean, I was writing columns. I wrote two columns a week, one for the daily and one for the weeklies, and doing all this radio and all this TV. And Frank calls me one day and he said, "Would you be interested in being the publications editor for the state 4-H office?" And I said, "Well, what does that entail?" And he said, "Well, you need to edit all of the bulletins. You end up writing some of them. We want you to do our TV work and our radio work, and we want you to be on the road speaking to 4-H at 4-H leader banquets around the state, and do leader training and that sounds kind of interesting." Ruth and I had just been married for a year, and Susie, as I mentioned earlier, was born in Green Bay. So Ruth and I talked about it, and she said, "Well, that'd be sort of interesting." And we would get a little bump in salary, because salaries were so pathetic. When I was in Green Lake, my salary was $4,600 a year, and it went up a little bit. So we moved to Madison in 1962. There were no interviews for anybody else. I was not interviewed. There was no job announcement placed. I was it. I became then the publications editor for the state 4-H office, which was a wonderful experience, because now I'm editing all this stuff that various professors are writing, and discovering that there are all these different writing styles. And most people who are writing, unfortunately, in higher education at least, think that what they've written is untouchable. And I said, "No kid can understand what in the world you're talking about." "What do you mean it's right here?" "Well, it might be right there." So I'm rewriting all this stuff. And I did that for 2.5 years. And I thought, geez, I don't want to keep rewriting other people's stuff and put their name on it. I just soon started doing my own stuff. So that's when I left the state 4-H office. I had an interesting opportunity, because Jim Duncan, who had been was professor in the Department of Ag and Extension Education, had an assignment in Brazil, working with a Brazilian university. And so I was on leave. And Walt Brocker, my old major professor, was chair of the department. He said, Jerry, would you be interested in teaching Jim's course, Jim Duncan's course? So for a year, I taught his course and did my editing stuff, and that was driving me up the wall. I couldn't do it all. So then Walt said, well, would you be interested in coming full-time into the department? So I did. Along the way, 6 years are passing. Now remember, I'm a faculty person. 6 years means you've got to come up for tenure. I never heard of tenure. That's so strange in those days. I had a master's degree, that's all. And and working at Extension, and Mitch Mackey was the personnel director, and he comes to me one day and he says, Jerry, you've got to, you've been here now long enough, you're eligible for tenure. And I said, what is that? And he says, well, you've got to have that. If you're going to stay here, you're going to have to get tenure. And I said, well, geez, I'm not very much interested in doing that, but if I've got to stay here, I guess I better do it. And he said, well, and I said, what's involved? And he said, well, I'll take care of it for you. He said, you've written a lot. I had written a bunch of stuff. I was writing articles, all these columns. He said, give me all that stuff, and I forgot about it. And a few weeks later, he comes in, he says, congratulations, you have tenure. I says, oh, well, that's good. And so I'm the last person in our department, in the Department of Ag and Extension Education, to have tenure with a master's degree.
That is amazing.
Actually, it was.
Yeah. So you got tenure. You had the master's degree. Then why?
But I wasn't. I had tenure as an assistant professor. That's also really unusual.
Okay.
Well, here I've got tenure, and now I'm in the department full time. So I'm only assistant professor for like a year or so, and then I'm associate professor, and then I think I was only associate professor a couple of years, and I'm a full professor. Because I write. And I didn't think anything of it, and apparently others thought that was a good thing, so.
And then when you got the PhD, you got it in education.
And real sociology.
And it seemed like you had this interest in adult learners.
Yes.
At that time.
I'm still am.
Tell me a little bit about, because you said the PhD was in education, that part was in the curriculum and instruction department.
That's right. I want to tell you about the story about how I got the PhD that comes back to my folks. Now, my Uncle Fred, my dad's brother, could not understand why anybody would ever want to go to college. And he said to my dad one time, and I'm going to work you through the progression. He said to my dad one time, he said, where did you go wrong, Herman? And my dad said, what do you mean? He said, well, you let your son go to college. And my dad said, well, he had a scholarship. Well, maybe Fred said, you know, the only reason anybody goes to college is to get out of work. You know that, don't you? And my dad didn't say anything. Then when I got a master's degree, my Uncle Fred said to my dad, I didn't think Jerry could get out of any more work. And now he's this master. What in the world does that mean? Well, I don't think he ever knew that I had a PhD degree. That part we left behind. But now we're here in Madison, and we have a little celebration at my brother lived here in Madison at the time, at his apartment. And we invited my major professor and my folks and a bunch of other people. And Bert Krylow was my major professor for my PhD. And Bert says to my mother, he said, you must be really proud of your son to have finished a PhD degree. A doctor's degree, he said. And my mother said to Bert, he said, he's no doctor. He can't even cure a chicken. For my mother, there were MDs and dentists and veterinarians. And after that, we were a bunch of phonies.
Right. Oh, I love that.
Oh, yeah.
When I want to talk also, I mean, obviously, in addition to your work at the university, you have this amazing body of work. You know, you've written, I know, over 30 plus books. So I want to talk a little bit about that, or a lot about that.
Sure.
I read that in 1967, you started writing a column, I think it was for the Washera Argus.
That is correct. And the story behind that goes like this. In 1966, I was on leave to finish my dissertation for my PhD degree. And it was so boring. I mean, in those days, the PhD dissertations were all cut and dried. The first chapter shall be this, the second chapter shall be that, and so on. And I would work on my dissertation in the morning. And in the afternoon, I'd write short stories and nonfiction articles. And then it dawned on me, it'd be kind of fun to write a weekly column that dealt with topics around nature, because we'd gotten our farm in 1966 as well. And so that's what I did. And that's how I got started writing Outdoor Notebook, which was an environmentally related column, but based on a lot of it first-person stuff about what was going on at the farm and how the seasons were changing and when the first sandhill cranes arrived and all of that kind of stuff. And people liked it for some strange reason. The editor said to me, well, we'll try it a few weeks and see if anybody cares. And they did, and soon I was in four newspapers, and $5 a week is what I got for my columns. It never changed. I did that for 10 years, $5 a week.
We should mention, too, you had mentioned in 1966, you still have that. Is this the same farm that you still own?
Yes, right.
That is correct. So everybody knows you have that.
Well, the story of that is that my dad was at the courthouse in Wautoma, and his cousin worked in the courthouse, and the cousin said to my dad, I know some property that's come up for sale based on back taxes. Would you be interested? My dad was in his 60s then. Well, he was 66 then. And he said, I've already got a farm. I don't need any more land. But the relative said, you can have this farm for back taxes. And back taxes are $15 an acre. And so you can have this farm for $1,500.
Wow.
And so my dad bought it. He gave it to his three sons for a dollar. I paid 33 and a third cents for my share of the farm.
And I know you said you still have it today.
I added to it. I bought 60 more acres. So.
And do your brothers also?
One of my brothers lives on that property still. He has 35 acres. The second brother, he has a PhD and worked in horticulture his career. And lived in New Jersey for 40 years. He'd just come back to Wild Rose. But I bought him out along the way so that I had the larger section of it.
I just want to make sure that we mention that because obviously this ties into your interest in the environment.
Oh, sure. Yeah. So anyway, I started writing this column, and soon I'm getting letters from people with comments and, this is impressing the editor. Then he said to me, Jerry, it'd be really good if you could add a picture, a photo with each of these columns. And that's when I made a little dark room downstairs in a closet. And those are the days of film and developing stuff. And so I was developing and printing pictures, which I submitted each week. One, still, he said, I can't give you more than $5 a week. So a photo and a 500 to 750 words every week. And that, I tell my writing students now that we all who are in this business need to serve an apprenticeship. That was my apprenticeship. The good, the bad, and the ugly, it didn't matter what I'd written, it all appeared in the paper, and I sure learned quickly about the ugly, because that's when people would say, oh, that was kind of lame, that last article you wrote. It was a wonderful experience, though.
I read that you said it taught you discipline and that you never missed a deadline.
I never did. I wrote 10 years of those 520. Interestingly enough, I'm back doing that again. The Country Today is a weekly newspaper that is available to farm families, well, anybody, in Wisconsin, Iowa, Minnesota. They have 50,000 readers, and I write an every other week column for them now. I just started doing that 2 weeks ago.
It's almost like full circle.
Isn't it the truth? Isn't it the truth? And except I don't have to provide the picture this time. And it is so fun because once this big documentary that they did on me that you may or may not want to talk about, once I came out, I've been getting requests from all over the place to do stuff, and that I like to do. The writing the column thing is fun. I've got, let's see, 650 words have to be in the mail every other week, and not in the mail, I email it now. And it's just fun. I love to do that.
Well, let's do talk about the documentary.
Okay.
So Wisconsin Public Television was doing a documentary, and I know, did they initially ask you to help? Was initially the focus going to be on you, or were you initially hired as an expert?
Oh, let me give you a little background. I began working with public television, 15 years ago maybe. What would happen, I give a lot of public lectures on all kinds of topics, generally related to my books. I have one on Old Farm, I have one on horses, I have one on the Ringling Brothers, and they would come and film those, and then you can watch, they still show them again and again. And then one day someone from public television said, well, would you be interested in working with us on a documentary that we're doing on old barns? And I had been I have a book on barns, it's in, third edition now. So I've been working with that for a long time. So I wrote I essentially wrote the script for that barn documentary, and did a lot of the narration, the background narration for it as well. So that got me started. That we developed a relationship at that time. I also was working with several independent film producers. I've done a thing on which will be showing on Sunday night on public television, the Haloff Gang on the WLS Barn Dance. I've major role in that. I worked with another, that film company is out of Chicago. I worked with another film company out of the Quad Cities on One Room Schools. I've worked with another guy from New Glarus on another barn show. I do a lot of that stuff. So I've had a lot of experience with it. Then I was working with public television doing a program in cooperation with the Wisconsin Alumni Association at a resort in northern Wisconsin. And I was giving a talk on the on Prohibition. I have a book on breweries of Wisconsin. In fact, I'm talking to the Historical Society tonight at the museum downtown on the history of the brewing industry in the state. And I'm talking to this group of alums about Prohibition, and they had a an introductory part to the Ken Burns' show on Prohibition, which came out a couple years ago. And so I'm to give the Wisconsin connection, and it was really interesting. And along the way, the leadership at public television had changed a little bit. And all of a sudden, they said, "We've got to do something on you." And I said, "Well, you better do it pretty soon, because I'm getting old. One of these days, I'm not going to have a voice anymore." And they said, "Oh, yeah, voice sounds pretty good still." And then they said to me, "Well, we looked at several different options. I wanted to do. I still will maybe sometime do a show on Wisconsin's environmental heroes, John Muir, Gaylord Nelson, and so on." But they said, "Well, that's not the right time to do that." Then somebody came up with the idea, well, because they'd been reading, somebody picked up one of my early books and said, "Well, you know, there's a lot of interesting farm history here that a lot of people don't know about." And that's where they decided that they would just focus on interviewing me and bringing in a bunch of other pictures along the way. So I'm essentially it. And it has been a remarkable experience, because I didn't think that after a handful of old-timers like myself that the interest would, that there wouldn't be any interest. But we, on one fundraising night, I'm really bragging now, my show beat out Downton Abbey, and that's saying something, I guess.
That is saying a lot. Given how popular
it impressed them anyway.
Yes.
So it's been one of their best fundraising shows, which says something about not me. It's about how people really are interested in Midwestern agricultural history, especially when they look at it from a personal perspective, and see what it means to somebody who lived it. Minnesota quickly bought the show. Iowa bought the show. Now it's national. They sold it nationally. It'd be everywhere starting in August. So now I'm getting requests to go to Omaha, to go to Kansas City, to go to Chicago, to help with the fundraising. They flew me up to Minneapolis. That was kind of fun to do that. So I have a double problem right now. I have more than that. The Limping Through Life book has touched the Rotary International people. Rotary has been a longtime sponsor of the eradication of polio internationally. So polio clubs everywhere in the country want me to speak. So I just learned yesterday, we are going public television, Historical Society and I will be doing a special show just on polio and me as part of the one of the public television series, and the Historical Society will keep the rights, and then they will send this out to all of the Rotary clubs in the country that want to learn about my experience with polio.
You know, I want to go back to your very first book, but before I do that, the question that's just burning on my tongue is, how have you managed to be so prolific? Oh, you know, you've written 30 plus books, and maybe it's closer to 50, as we were saying.
Yeah, I don't know how to count them. I've got books in Arabic, Portuguese, Spanish, and all kinds of...
Not only the environmental, but I know you also have some adult education, a few. You do a lot of radio, so the public television too. Just this April, you had both the polio book, and then you also had I'm looking for the title, with George with the Depression. The book that just came out in April 2013.
Letters from Hillside Farm.
Thank you. Letters from Hillside Farm.
Yeah, that's my sixth novel, by the way.
And that's the thing. You also expand, you do nonfiction, you do fiction. With this remarkable career, how have you managed to be so prolific over different genres and topics?
I have no idea. I really don't. I get bored sticking in one tight little area. I generally, right now, this sounds so strange to my writing students find this just impossible. I generally am writing at least three books at the same time.
I read that about you, and I know more coming out. How do you keep them straight?
How do you compartmentalize? How do you keep it? I don't have any problem with that at all. I read five books at the same time. And people think that's nonsense. I do. I have four or five books I'm reading. I'm halfway through this one, a third through another one. And I read a lot of fiction, but I also read a lot of nonfiction. And I do a tremendous amount of research for all my books.
So tell me about your day. Where do you find... You know, I'm curious about two things. How you found the time when you were younger, I'm curious about, when you obviously had a younger family and a full-time job. I'm curious about that. And I'm also a little bit curious about how you find it today. I know you're somewhat, you talked to me that you have a writing time and you have a writing schedule and you try to protect it. But I guess my friend, let's talk about when you were younger. How did you manage to do that?
Well, remember, I got up at 5:30 in the morning and the farm. Well, I still got up at 5:30 in the morning, and I have in the basement where the storm windows were stored was my writing space. And the first desk was an old door with legs screwed on the corners that wiggled and wobbled. And Ruth and I had an agreement that until I made enough money writing, that would be where I would write. And that was a great incentive. So I finally sold enough stuff that I could fix up the room a little bit in the cellar. And when the carpenter came in to do it, I said, "Now I want the room insulated all the way around." He said, "Why? You don't insulate inside rooms." I said, "We have three little kids." And so I could shut the door. And so 5:30 in the morning, I would write from 5:30 to... 7:30. I'd at least get 2 hours in every day before I go to work. I did that for years. You need to hear me applaud Ruth, my wife's putting up with all this. Here she's getting the kids ready to school, and I'm downstairs writing on something or another. That Ruth's been a fantastic support of what somebody would call all this nonsense. Here you're pushing 80 years old, and you're still writing like a fiend. What's wrong with you? When are you going to retire? And my quick answer is, well, I haven't thought about that yet. Another thing that I've been blessed with is good health. It sounds so weird. It's almost ironic. Here I'm suffering. I'm back with some polio syndrome symptoms. But by and large, my head works, my fingers work. And interestingly enough, people with arthritis in their fingers, I would say take up typing. It really helps. It really does help. And I have a lot of energy. I've always had energy. And I've got this weird imagination. I'm still looking in the shadows and listening to the whispers and hearing all and seeing all kinds of things that other people don't see. I had a guy come up to me the other day, he's looking at one of my adult ed books, and he said, "You were 10 years ahead of yourself." And I said, "That's probably why the book didn't sell worth a hoop when it came out."
Going back to that very first book, I read that you were writing the outdoor notebook, and you said you had a mentor, Robert Gard.
Robert Gard, yep.
Talk to me a little bit about the role he played in helping you get that very first book published.
Yeah. Bob Gard was the Wisconsin folklorist. He came here from Kansas via Cornell University, where he had done a master's degree in theater arts. Bob was a Kansas farm boy. I met him in 1960, I believe, when he helped me put on a drama festival for 4-H kids in Green Bay. That was one of his jobs, to go around and help extension people. And Bob knew that I was interested in writing. I mean, we talked about it. And when I had gotten down here to Madison, I went to him one day with a, this was after I was writing this column, with a whole handful of these columns. And I said, "Bob, is there any way that this might become a book?" And he said, "Well," a very slow way of talking, "well, it might, but most people are not that interested in just a book of columns. You need to do more than that." And I said, what do you mean by that?" And he says, "Well, you got to write a story. Even though it's nonfiction, it's still a story, and I'll help you with that." And he did. And so those columns are, you can't even recognize them in the book, because I developed characters, including an old tree. The first character in the book is an old black willow tree. That's kind of a metaphor for all that went on during that time environmentally. And of course, the 60s, I had a chance to sit in on Gaylord Nelson's Earth Day talk that he gave at the Stock Pavilion, the first Earth Day speech that Gaylord Nelson, he wrote the introduction to my book, That Land Still Lives.
I read that you said it helps to have a niche. Did you pick your niche, or did it pick you in terms of the environment?
That's such a good question, because at one time when I decided I wanted to become a freelance writer rather than just a writing for my job, I wrote everything under the sun. I tried all kinds of stuff. But then, and I don't know if somebody told me this, I don't think so. I think I sort of figured it out for myself. What do I know best, and what am I really passionate about? And that defined my niche. And I try to tell my writing students, especially the beginners who are writing all over the place, I say, what's your passion? What are you really interested in? Don't worry so much about the audience, worry about yourself and what grabs your interest. And the rest will take care of itself. And Michael, that really works. That worked for me.
You started out the interview with, I talked about how you had said that where you grow up and when you grow up influences
That's true.
Your life. Yeah. Right? You know, I hear when you say you've picked, you know, what you know best was the farm and the land and nature. I also read, and I want to close with this, the last line in your book, Limping Through Life, with, you talk about polio, And you said at the last line, if it hadn't been for the polio, I might not be writing this book.
That's true.
When you think back about your life and everything that you've done, do you see it, I guess, the polio, do you see it as a blessing or a curse or both?
Yes. It really is both. Because I so wish that I didn't have to limp around and do all of that. I so much enjoy wilderness camping and canoeing, and a lot of that I can't do anymore. Although Steve and I have gone to the Boundary Waters, this will probably be our 30th year without missing. And I can scarcely get in and out of the canoe anymore, but my arms work really well. So once I'm in the canoe, away we go. And that's the curse part of it. The positive stuff, and I may have done this anyway. I love ideas. I'd like to think. I still have this imagination that won't quit. And people say, where do you come up with the ideas for the books? And I just can't seem to. I can't turn it off. I mean, I've got half a dozen books in my head all the time that I think ought to be written. I throw away as many ideas as I work on, probably more. My wife's my first critic. If I write something and she says, that just stupid, that's not going to go anywhere. And I sometimes, more often than not, she's right.
And what about growing up on a farm? A blessing?
That to me is a blessing, not a curse at all. And I was, for so many years, just like polio, I didn't want anybody to know that I'd grown up on a farm without electricity, without indoor plumbing, walking to a country school. I mean, that was too often people had a prejudice against that as being, well, they're a bunch of country bumpkins, never had an original thought in their life, and they're just sitting back there. Well, it ain't like that, folks. It's not. Watch out. Those people who've grown up on farms, be careful in stereotyping them, because they range the whole gamut just like the rest of society.
Thank you. It's been a really fun interviewing
you. You're welcome.